Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Dishing with Digest. I'm Stephanie Sloan, editorial director here with Mara Levinsky, senior editor.
Hi, everyone.
Mara, big news in our new issue. Sean Kanan is back at Bold and Beautiful after a four-year absence in which we saw his character, Deacon, carted off to prison for taking shots at Quinn. So Sean tells us he's thrilled to be back and had the biggest smile on his face driving through the gates at CBS. And this time around, we're going to see Deacon team up with Sheila, played by Kimberlyn Brown. Now, fun fact, these two have never worked together before, so they're both really looking forward to exploring that dynamic, and I think it's going to be great.
I agree. You know, I think Deacon is probably B&B's most iconic bad boy, and it goes without saying that Sheila is the show's most iconic villainess. And what could be better than an unholy alliance between them? When we had Sean on the podcast a few months ago, I think it was obvious how much affection he has for Deacon, how much fun he thought Deacon was to play. And I was just so excited for him on a personal level that he's back on the canvas. But story-wise, I think there's so much potential for him. You know, whatever he and Sheila cook up, obviously, is at the top of that list, but also getting to see him with his daughter, Hope, and he's got some exes still in town, so I am getting my popcorn ready. Another return fans have to look forward to this week is taking place on Y&R. The uber-popular duo of Summer and Kyle will be back on screen in the form of Michael Mueller and Hunter King, whose characters are set to attend the Italian nuptials of Ashlyn and Victoria. So they had hinted when they were guests on the podcast that it wouldn't be long before we saw them again. And I am sure many Skyle fans are super duper excited that the time has come. We have interviews with both of them in the new issue. Michael described being back on set as like going back to school after summer break. And Hunter admitted that she was a little uncomfortable at first because she felt like she was in the spotlight since she hadn't been there for a while. But within minutes, it felt like old times. So they both really cherished getting to be back with their Y&R family. And we can only hope that this is the first of many visits from the two of them.
Oh, hear, hear. Now, Janice Lind, an original cast member of Young and the Restless, will also be back as Leslie at that wedding you mentioned. Our colleague Devin Owen spoke to her, and a couple of things I never knew. One, that she really played piano, and also that she's an opera singer. We will see her tickle the ivories at the celebration for Victoria and Ashlyn. And I don't know, there's just a fun little story about her that people should read in our new issue. Mm-hmm. Now, a headline I haven't really had the opportunity to write before in my 25 or so years of covering Days of Our Lives is The Devil Wants Ben and Sierra's Baby. So yes, Satan will urge Marlena to convince Ben that having a child is the best idea because the devil wants that baby for himself. So I spoke to Rob Wilson, who plays Ben, and it's really funny getting everyone's perspective on being part of the possession story. I mean, the sentiment has been unanimous from all of the actors I've spoken to, and that they are psyched to be part of such an iconic Days tale.
Well, how could you not? I mean, this is a water cooler moment for the show, for sure. Well, when it comes to iconic GH stories, our guest today, Fanola Hughes, has been a part of so many of them over the years that she has played the super spy Anna Devane, and her fans are just as passionate about her and her character today as they were when she rose to fame in the 80s, and I couldn't be more thrilled to chat with her today.
Oh, me too. I mean, I always say she is the actress and character who we get the most mail about and is as popular today as she was when she first debuted back when I was a viewer of the show. So let's get her on the line and talk about all things Fanola Hughes. Hi, Fanola.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. I'm in sunny California. We actually had rain yesterday, so we're super excited. Everybody's sort of walking around dazed, you know, they're like, what was that strange stuff from the sky? Weird.
Well, we have been looking forward to this podcast since we started podcasting, so we couldn't be more excited to talk to you today.
It's so fun. This is so fun. You're two of my favorite ladies. Totally. It's just really great.
Ditto. Well, speaking of rain, we're going to start in the beginning. You were born and raised in London. Tell us about your childhood.
My childhood was, when I look back on it, it was pretty charmed because all I seem to remember is dancing. You know, I sort of danced my way through it all. And my mom put me in ballet when I was three, and that was it. I took to it like a duck to water or a swan to the lake. And and that was it. You know, I just, we had a pretty, we weren't well off at all. You know, everything I did, me and my brother, we got like grants and scholarships and stuff like that to different schools. And, you know, he's a surgeon now. So he went to medical school and I came to America. And, my parents died young. I lost them when I was sort of 18 or something. And my dad when I was 20, 23, 24. And so, like Ian likes to say, we're that special sort of adult orphan. It's all good. And I'm very close with my brother and very close with him. He's really like my favorite person in the whole world. He's amazing. Oh. And that's it. You know, it was like a big Irish family, like, you know, lots of Irish stuff. whatever that is. Ireland, you know, we went every summer to see. There's just 1,000 people. Once you're part of an Irish family, you kind of walk along the street in Cork and people will be like, oh, that's your cousin over there. And like, I've like never seen her in my life. Okay. And two people turned up to my wedding and they were standing right in front of me and they're like, where are your you know, long lost cousins from such and such? And I was like, how did you get in?
I hear about it.
How are you here? And they're like, oh, we came with Auntie so-and-so. She thought you wouldn't mind. And I'm like, I just have to set you a place for dinner. I mean, yeah, sure. But yeah, it was great. I mean, like, and even to this day, you know, there's like a lot of us over here in America. So I have cousins here who I probably don't know. But anyway.
Well, maybe they'll reach out to you after this podcast.
They may well.
So I'm so interested in the fact that you started dancing when you were three. I know you started ballet shortly thereafter, I think at 10. So I'm curious if it feels to you like something that you actively chose to pursue or if it was just sort of always part of your life and you just went along with it naturally.
I'm not sure. I think my mom took me to like the Ballet Rambert was right around the corner to where we lived. And for some reason, my mom was, you know, she was quite daring. And I think she just opened the side door to like where they were rehearsing. I remember this so clearly. And I must've been like three, I mean, or five maybe at that point. And she opened the door and we were looking down on all these people dancing. And I remember saying, oh, I have to do that. I want to do that. And she was like, okay. And we closed the door. Like, I think we stood there for a little while, but and then, you know, and then I just was really lucky. I had these amazing teachers who, Rita Dias was, she was my first ballet teacher and, you know, they just all kind of inspired me. And really it was just about being the center of attention. I mean, I think, you know, we can just be as basic as that. I was like, damn, people are looking at me. Great. Like, yeah. And I've never stopped since. I'm still here.
One of your claims to fame is that you originated the role of Victoria, the White Cat, in the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical Cats, one of the most successful musicals of all time.
And now and forever.
Yes, now and forever. And in fact, you were one of the first dancers in the door to start working with the choreographer. So can you describe the experience of just working in that musical and then living through it becoming such a phenomenon?
Well, yeah, I mean, Gillian Lynn was the choreographer, a fabulous, renowned choreographer, amazing woman, passed away a couple of years ago. Just incredible. Like, that's a real true inspiration. Like, her, like, Gillian Lynn and then Gloria Monty. Like, these were two powerhouse women that really shaped my early life, you know, after my mother, obviously. And Jilly sort of took me under her wing, and there was probably three of us and her assistant, who she just choreographed the whole show on. She like just started on us, and we were there for 6 weeks prior to anybody else coming in, which was this sort of wonderful bubble. And Andrew would come in all the time. Trevor Nunn, who was the director, he didn't come in that often, but he waited until everybody came in, because he was more of the director of the, you know, of the whole show in a way. And Jilly was the choreographer, obviously, and Andrew was wrote the music. And I remember one day Andrew coming in, and he said, I've got a refrain. Very sweetly, quietly spoken man. And I have a refrain. I want to just try it. And so he started to play that theme, the Cats theme, which is, you know, but just single on the piano. He said, you know, I just want to try this, just one pianist playing this, which was him, just a pianist. And it was the, you know, this theme. And Jilly said, why don't we just have one cat, like sort of in the middle of the stage and just a spotlight, and we'll do this. And then she just choreographed this little thing, and which was this little solo that's Victoria's solo at the beginning of the show. And I remember sort of standing there as he was playing this, and Jilly said, why don't you just be a cat stretching? And so we just sort of started to roll around the floor, and she did some movements. And so she sort of stood me in the middle of the room, and she just said, why don't you just start stretching like a cat? So I just started to do some movements, and she started to choreograph some stuff, and it was just the two of us. And I remember thinking, this is pretty special right now, whatever this is. I have no idea what this is. And I was 21, I guess, maybe 20, maybe 20. And Andrew was playing, and he started to get really excited, and he was like, oh, how about we do this? And that was that little solo, and it was pretty cool. And I remember, like, when we did the first night, I just remember thinking, I never doubted for a second this was going to be a huge success. Whereas it's been recorded that Cameron McIntosh, who was the producer, the, you know, executive producer, and Trevor and Andrew and Jilly were all out in the bar, and they were drinking, like, for the first act. And this is in Cameron's documentary, actually, when he talks about it. And they were just like, oh, the audience is silent. Like, this is all going downhill. Let's just get super drunk. And anyway, the first act finished, and the audience erupted, and the three of them ran to the doors and were looking through, and they couldn't believe what was happening. And the four of them just ran to the door, and they could see that the audience had erupted. And that was it. That was the beginning.
I read this really fascinating interview with you from 1982, right before Cats premiered on Broadway, where you said, I don't want to be an actor. And you explained that you just felt a freedom in dance that you didn't feel when you were acting, and you felt more control as a dancer than an actor. But we know that by 1983, you were starring opposite John Travolta in Stayin' Alive. So there was obviously some overlap between dance and acting. But how did you make the transition, or I guess how and why did your transition from dancing to acting come about?
You know, it was actually a moment with Trevor Nunn and during Cats, and he invited each of us up, and he gave us three words that were to be our character. He whispered them in our ear. Not weird at all. I remember when he said the three words that were mine, which I have now forgotten, that I thought, oh, this must be what acting is about. It's about developing a character, and you have some words that sort of, you know, describe your character. And I remember being fascinated. And so that was the big hook. And then Mike Lee, who was a big, big director in England, just started to put out these amazing, he had probably started in 1979, maybe earlier, putting out these incredible movies and plays. And they were so real that I remember looking at those thinking, if I could do something like that, you know, that would be very cool. And I don't know, it was just something that kind of resonated with me. And I guess there is a certain control that you have with dance because you're in control of your instrument. And whereas you're not so much, because acting is a bit more ephemeral and you know, there's just, it changes from moment to moment, like with what your partner gives you and what suddenly occurs. And it's all more improvisational in a way, even though you have a script, blah, blah, blah. But I don't know. I mean, maybe I use the disciplines of dance in acting and vice versa. I don't know.
Well, tell us about getting cast in Staying Alive and then also working with John Travolta.
Okay, so I was doing another Andrew Lloyd Webber show called Song and Dance. And just a casting director called me and said, would you come in and read for this part? And I was like, sure. And it was just an English role. I mean, it was just and she was a dancer and she was kind of bitchy. And I just, that was it. I mean, it was put on tape. And that tape got sent to Sly, I guess, Ty Stallone. And then maybe a week or so later, they were like, oh, we'd like you to fly out to Hollywood and audition for this. And I was like, what, wait, what? And so that happened. And I remember getting in the car. I was picked up at the airport. Like, I flew first class to LA, which was stupid. I was 22. 21 still, probably 21, 22, because it was, oh no, maybe, I mean, it's all, I can't remember. Anyway, it was within those first 3 years of your 20s. And the man who picked me up, he had a woman, what was his name? I can't remember what his name was. Anyway, I'll think of it. And he was the driver. And he became my driver, actually, when I shot the movie, which was really cool. Really, really sweet, sweet man. And I remember saying to him, do people get flown out to do auditions like a lot? And he said, oh yeah, it happens. And I was like, oh, okay. So I just thought, oh, all right. So that's, you know, I'm just one of those people that get flown out for auditions. But yeah, you know, when I did the audition, you know, I did it with John and he was there. I did the dancing audition first and then the acting thing. And then Sly said, well, we'd like you to play this role. And I just was like, oh, okay, thanks. And he was like, what? Like, you're not going to jump up and down and scream or something? And I remember saying, well, I'm English.
We don't do that.
And that, you know, and so he laughed. Mm-hmm. And that was that.
And how was working with John?
God, he's the best person ever. He's just the best. I just adore him. He was so kind. Like just really, I mean, I know I've said this over and over. He's just really kind and like a really genuine person. And took me under his wing, you know, he looked after me. I'd never been to America. It was great. It was really fun.
Well, fast forward to 1985 and Gloria Monty, the legendary executive producer of GH, who you mentioned, was said to have wanted someone like the woman from Staying Alive to take on the role of Anna, a woman from Robert's past. So what do you remember about how getting that job came about?
I didn't have any clothes to wear for the audition. And I was sleeping on the couch of a really, 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 really dear friend of mine, Donna, who is still one of my best friends. And I'd met her during Staying Alive, actually. And she was casting director assistant. Now she's like a massive casting director. So I was sleeping on her couch. I've been there for 6 weeks. Yes, I know all the stories about 3 days and everything, but yeah, for 6 weeks. And she, to her credit, hadn't said, get out of my house. Because she was still, you know, she used to go to work every day looking immaculate because she was a trainee somewhere or other for being a casting director. And so I got an audition to go to this role on General Hospital. And I'm like, you know, what can you tell me about General Hospital? So Donna sat me down and we watched some of the soaps. And she said, you've got to look really good. And I was like, yeah, I mean, these girls, they look amazing. And so she lent me a cobalt blue padded shoulder silk dress, which was de rigueur. It was 1984, I think.
Yes, sir. Shoulder pads, of course.
Massive blue and a string of pearls, which I had never worn. And so that's how I went to the audition. And it was on a soundstage. And I remember going to the audition. And I had this, it was an audition where I was playing opposite someone that was supposedly Robert. And then I called, I had to use one of those old fashioned phones. And like I speed dialed somebody, I called somebody on a phone that was on the wall. So it was literally on the wall. And I remember thinking, why don't I call? In my mind, I thought I should call somebody that means something to me. And so I did. And for some reason, I decided to get emotional for the phone call. I'm not sure it was in the script, but I was like, that's sort of interesting that I'm calling someone that means a lot to me. And so I did that because, you know, there was nobody at the other end of the line. I could do whatever I wanted. Mm-hmm. So I didn't hear anything for weeks. And one day they called and said, yeah, they want you to come in and play this role. Again, it was sort of, oh, okay. Yeah. And so that was that. I don't know why I didn't hear anything. I think maybe they were auditioning lots of other people.
I guess we'll go with her.
Let's take her. She got all weird on the phone. That might be interesting.
Shows great promise.
Yeah, she has great promise. She's as nutty as we are. Let's go with her. Yeah, great.
Well, what are your early memories of Tristan Rogers, who played Robert?
So he comes into my dressing room. I'm sure I've told these stories before because there's only a few of them, like from that first day. But he comes into my dressing room and is like, "You want to rehearse?" And I'm like, "Sure." And he looked like Steve McQueen. Okay, this is the first time I'd seen him because I didn't know who I was playing opposite. And even though I'd watched the show, I still, you know, I didn't really, you know, take it in. I wasn't sure what was happening really. And so he comes in and he props himself up on the sink. And I'm sitting on the couch and I'm like, he looks like Steve McQueen. Oh my God. Like, and then he just starts rehearsing and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, okay. And we just rehearse and I know my words, I know my lines and I'm all ready. So we go upstairs and we do the scene where I think the first scene we did together was at the bar and a cocktail gets pushed towards him. It's one of those cocktails that I don't know what they're called. Some clever person's going to know. And it's where they're, I guess the different liqueurs are put in there as to how much they weigh and they make stripes. And it was a little cocktail thing gets pushed over towards him. And apparently that was our drink, which it looked disgusting, but anyway. And we start working together. We do like all these scenes. And as we walk away from the set, he's walking next to me and puts his arm around me and goes, "We're going to have fun, kid." That was all he said. And I was like, okay. And he's called me kid ever since. Kid. Like even today, it's like, you know, all right, kid. I'm like, yeah.
Well, speaking of kids, you were like 23, 24, and they say, guess what? You have a seven-year-old. Kimberly McCall is Robin. She described to
us... The legend.
The living legend. So, you know, it really kind of always just strikes me at how wild it is that you had to play all these things that you weren't close to experiencing in real life. And you did it so amazingly well. Like looking back, how do you think you did it?
Well, she was adorable. It was just so easy. It was like falling off a log. I mean, you know, you just like, you know, you just wanted to squeeze her. And so, and she was so good, you know, like when we auditioned her, cause I know it's hard to believe, but I would say 40 to 50% of everything we did was improvised back then. Like for certain people, like Tristan.
And Mainly Tristan.
And, you know, but Gloria loved it. She loved it because she was like, you know, if you have something better that you want to say, or just come back to the story at some point. And, So she asked this little girl, like Kimberly, she said, can you improvise with these two monsters that were me and Tristan? And she just gave us as good as we, you know, she just gave us as good as we got. And she was amazing. And we were like, oh yeah, this is it. This was so easy. It was just so easy. All of it was so easy. Like, I don't remember. It was all play. Like, we were just playing so much of the time. And we were allowed to live. Like, you know, if you were doing a scene where people getting into bed, like the little girl used to get into bed with us in the morning and jump on, you know, if you were doing scenes like that, they would just go on and on. Tristan would say something and then I would say something. And, you know, like he would get out of bed and the camera would be like, oh gosh, you know, I'm going to follow him. And nobody really knew where he was going to stand or what he was going to do. And Gloria would just say, follow him, just follow them. Which the cameraman did. I mean, you know, and today they'll do the same thing, but it's not asked of them as much. You know, they really, because we move much faster. It was just different. It was very much about living on camera. And they just wanted us to sort of do that, inhabit the characters. Gloria was all about that. It was pretty cool. And little Kimberly did exactly that.
Amazing. Well, if anyone doesn't know who the Ian you've been referring to is, in 1986, Anna got a new love interest, Duke Lavery, played by Mr. Ian Buchanan. So obviously he is an important person in your life still today. Yeah. And the Duke and Anna love story was super popular. So what are your standout memories of the early days of your friendship with Ian and the Duke and Anna era in general?
Well, he was just so self-contained. Like, he was just so, you know, elegant and suave and just really, like, he was a huge influence on me. I mean, I'm not going to lie. Like, both Tristan and Ian. Because you spend most of your time working with these guys. And I, like, he'd come from, the Actors Studio in New York. So it was different style. Like, he had a different style. And I think I started to adopt that style. It was just very minimal, like his wardrobe, unlike me, who had frills and God knows what. He was very, you know, he was very wore black and was, you know, very, very put together. And he taught me a lot about just listening and waiting for things to feel right before you spoke and all kinds of stuff like that. There was a great confidence to his work, I have to say. You know, where Tristan would like be daring and kind of roll with the punches and not give you the line that he was supposed to, which was great because you then had to, you know, figure it out. Ian would also improvise like a lot, but it was different. It was just a really different connection that the two characters had and that I had with Ian. And So I'm, you know, he's godfather to my kids and, you know, or I'm very, very close to him, very close to him. And it's a great friendship that I'm so fortunate that he walked into my life and I walked into his, vice versa. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of fun.
You know, something else I'm curious about. So when you started the show, when were you told about the scar?
So when I started, like she said, do like Gloria said, came down to hair and makeup and said, I want you to do her hair like Veronica Lake, like sort of bend it and have it go over one eye. And I was like, cool. You know, I'd seen Veronica Lake. I knew who she was. And she said, it's mysterious. And I was like, okay. So I don't know that they were going to keep me because I only had, like, I didn't have like a long contract. And then one day they came in and they said, I think I had a 3-month contract and they said, we want to extend your contract. We're just going to do it now. We want to start a new contract with you. And it was like 3 years. And I was like, okay, sure. It was around that time. So what my guess is that they were going to maybe spring the scar on me. And then, you know, I was going to be out of there. I don't know what the whole deal was. Cause I was basically brought in for Emma's exit, like Emma Sams was exiting to go to do Colby's. So I was brought in around that time. And I think it was to make this, that transition or something. I mean, look, I don't know, you know, I'm pretending I know what was going on. I didn't, I just was, you know, cleaning my teeth and going to work. So Gloria called me into her office, and that was never good. Like when you were called into Gloria's office, two things were never good. One was when the footsteps were heard on the soundstage, click, 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 click. And you would be standing in a scene and you'd be looking around and you'd be like, I hope it's you. And it's not me. Whoever you were looking at, you're like, I hope it's you. It's not me. In your head, you're just like, God, don't let it be me. And so click, click, click. That was one thing. The other thing was, please go to Gloria Monty's office. It's the same now. If you're like, can you, like at the end of a scene, it'll come over the tannoy. So-and-so, can you please go to Frank's office? And it's always James. It's always James Patrick. And it's always, James, can you go to Frank's office? And I always look at him like, it's you. I get it. I'm like, bye. It was really nice working with you. And I say that every time he gets called. I don't know why he always gets called to the office, but you know. It's usually because he's giggling. So I get called to Gloria's office and she says, I want you to watch something. Darling, I want you to watch something. And so she had a television on the wall, which I thought was so glamorous. Because now, you know, every three-year-old has a television on their wall. So she's showing a black and white movie, which was Joan Crawford, A Woman's Face. Is that Joan Crawford? I think so. Anyway, somebody will correct me, I'm sure. And she is walking up a staircase or coming down a staircase and it's all lit, you know, that fabulous lighting in the black and white movies. And she leans against the wall and then she turns and she's dramatically talking to somebody up the staircase or down the staircase, I don't know. And you see her face, it's like, you know, pizza. And I'm like, wow, okay. And she says, this is what we're going to do with you. And I'm like thinking, what, we're going to shoot it all in black and white? What's happening? I don't know. And she goes, we're giving you a scar. And I'm like, oh, no. And then she tells me the story that it's like, you know, this, there was this explosion and I was double agent and I double crossed Robert and it's going to be why your relationship ended and we're going to do a whole backstory. And so I was like, okay. And I remember walking away from there going, oh my gosh, I'm going to pull that off. And yeah. And then later, when they decided they were going to keep me, which probably came after that conversation, was when they then decided, oh, she's just wearing it for penance. And yeah, that was a whole other thing. And it was sort of like the moment when Ian came onto General Hospital this time and we were called up to Frank's office before we started working. And Frank said, okay, so Ian, you're really Faison right now. And so the journey up in the elevator, me and Ian, we were like, oh, I wonder what it's about. Oh, yes, you're starting, blah, 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 talk, chat, 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 chat. He's just going to give you an insight into where we're going, I'm sure. And then the journey down was silent. You crickets. Because we were like, nothing. We had nothing. And we had to go on set and work right then and there. So that we had like literally 20 minutes to kind of send that through the computer in the brain. And yeah, so we were processing it still as we were shooting the scenes that he was actually phase on.
That's amazing.
That was our heads up. But you know, I guess it's a good way of doing it. Mm-hmm. You just, you know, it's all instinct.
Well, around the same era, you did a project that I absolutely must mention. And that's your 3-episode stint on LA Law as Lauren in 1987, because I recently found out, and I've already shared with you, that it was that appearance that kicked off my father's decades-long crush on you. He has never been impressed by anything that I have done professionally, except for when I was like, oh, I know her. Now I'm his favorite daughter. So what was that experience like? And what was it like to work with Jimmy Smits, who was your character's love interest?
The only part of that experience was working with Jimmy Smits. That was all of it. Like, I don't remember anything else. I don't remember words. I don't remember anything. I just remember Jimmy Smits. And I was like, so excited. Like, it was my birthday every day. Mm-hmm. And I did, yeah, 3 episodes, I guess. I wasn't very good, but I was like, because I remember I was supposed to cry and I was so nervous that I couldn't feel emotional. It was weird. But, and then also they gave me a cigarette to smoke. And I hadn't yet met Anders, so I didn't know how to do it really well. And so and coming from London, you'd think I would, but I was not very, you know, and I wasn't inhaling. I wasn't doing it right. Because they were like, oh, because I think I was the murderer. In the end, it was discovered. But anyway, yeah, it was great. Jimmy was amazing and gorgeous, like just gorgeous. Just a lovely, beautiful human being. I just loved him. And he was great to work with and easy on the eyes.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Anders, in 1990, Anna's life was rocked by the arrival of César Faison, played by Anders Hove, a dangerous and obsessive villain from her past. So tell us about working with him.
Well, he taught me how to smoke.
3 years too late.
As soon as he left, I stopped because I was like, this is revolting. Yeah, I was not a smoker. As soon as he started, it was a different game. Like, he brought a whole other game to the show for me. And it was so daring. And just used to talk about different ways of doing scenes where, he would talk about like underneath, like what we were really doing, which wasn't actually what the words were. And so that was a whole other level. And I took to that like a duck to water. And he was great. He was a great person to work with. Fantastic nemesis for Anna, like amazing. And just, I think some of my, most interesting scenes have been with him or about him. And, just a really, and I think the scenes with Ian and him and, I think the three of us just play really well together. And I really enjoyed him. But for me, like the best scene that he's ever done, or not that he's ever done, because he's incredible. He's the best. He's the best villain ever. That's to coin Kimberly McCullough's words, because she was tied up. He was keeping her tied up. And he came over to the hospital bed where he was, and he was talking to her, and I was watching, I was watching. And when they called cut, Kimberly just turned to the camera and she went, best villain ever. And I just remember thinking, yeah, best villain ever. And the scene that kills me is the scene that he did with Michael Easton, where he's come to my apartment and he's looking for Anna. And he's talking about Anna being in love with him. And Michael's like, I don't know, have you looked at yourself? Just like these just amazing lines that just back and forth. And he played it for such drama. That's the beauty of Anders. His instincts are ridiculous. His instincts are ridiculous. Like he's won awards, so many awards in his native land. I mean, he's just in Denmark, he's just known as this amazing stage actor. So, and we got to work with him. So he plays the whole thing for pathos and drama. And then you've got Michael Easton on the other side, just playing the whole thing as this straight comedy. And it's the best. And I just happened to be up on set because, I was in the next couple of scenes or whatever. And I was watching this and I was biting my tongue because it was amazing. It was an amazing scene. For me, that is like, that's my favorite kind of work. When there's drama and comedy in the same kind of milieu, it's amazing.
Well, yeah. The year after Anders joined the show, you decided to leave the show after 6 years, I think, at that point.
Seven.
So tell us about making that decision.
Well, it was sort of a decision made for me. Like, I got another job. I mean, I got, and it was for ABC. So it was an ABC job. So it was sort of in-house, and I thought everybody was cool with it. I guess at that point, I don't know. I just sort of, maybe it was a rash decision. I don't know. But I just sort of felt like I should go and try this other gig. And it was great. I mean, that was Jack's Place, and it was with Hal Linden, and, you know, that was, it was really lovely to work with someone of his caliber, just that, you know, he, and of course, like, I grew up watching some of his amazing shows. And so the thing I can say about Hal and John Dye, who was my co-star in it, was that Hal just had this comedic metronome. Just knew exactly how to say anything comedic. It was really a masterclass. Like, John and I used to just, we would laugh at ourselves because we were like, oh, okay, so we're playing backgammon and he's playing chess. So, you know, who loses? Well, I guess me, us. And yeah, it was really great. Yeah, that was a very cool experience.
You also appeared on several seasons of Blossom. You were in the Aaron Spelling primetime soap Pacific Palisades, and you had a recurring role on Charmed. So is there a role or a show from that era that's closest to your heart?
Well, look, Pacific Palisades, I met my bestie. I met Michelle Stafford. And we were on the phone a lot last night. She makes me laugh so much. And So that came out of that. And also Aaron Spelling, like we got to work with Aaron, who was just, oh my gosh, such a king of what he did. Like, just really, you know, just really, like, he was so invested in every aspect of the work. Like, you know, he made decisions about the way we look. Like, each character had to have their own look. And you weren't allowed to change your hair or do anything without his say-so. And so he just understood television. He said, you know, when people turn the television on, they need to know who they're looking at immediately. So you have to look, sound, and behave. This, you know, is just your characters. So they were all so amazing, like Charmed. I made so many great friends there. And that was such an incredible show. I wish I'd done more of those, but then by that point I'd moved to New York to do All My Children. So I missed out on a lot of those episodes. And then I like to think that with Blossom, I helped them jump the shark. And because the show ended pretty much the year that I joined. So, yeah. Or maybe 2 years, the second year that I was there. But they, you know, Mayim Bialik, smart, smart person, and Joey Lawrence, just really great families, and, you know, working with kids. And then Ted Wass, who was just a great guy, all around great guy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, lots of good folks. So, all right, so you came to do All My Children first as Alex, the heretofore unknown twin of Anna, later as Anna. I don't think I've ever talked to an actor who less enjoys a dual role than you, Finola Hughes. But one thing really great that came out of your time on All My Children were so many great friendships that I know you still have today, including Ms. Kelly Ripa and Mr. Mark Consuelos. We just saw you and Kelly reunite on her talk show. Why do you think you guys clicked as well as you clearly did?
I'm not sure. You know, she's a force. She's amazing. She's just amazing. And it's really funny. Like, I spoke to Dylan, just like when we got back here, and I said, oh God, that was so great. Like, cause we went out to the Hamptons and we spent, you know, most of the time with them, and the kids all kind of reunited because they all grew up when they were younger. Like, we would go out and spend holidays with them and different things. And, my son Dylan said, yeah, it was really interesting. Cause we just, like, you know, just were chatting all the time. And he said, it was really interesting to watch you two talking because you have a real connection. And I don't know. I mean, her brain is so active. She's just a she just gets so much about life, and she's always just been like that. And I think the first time I met her, and I know this has been said before, is she was walking down the hallway to me in the back hallways of all my children. This lovely blonde girl who I did actually, like, I actually did my homework on all my children. I actually watched the show and I understood what I was walking into. I knew who John Callahan was, and I knew who Susan was, obviously. And I knew who she was and Cameron, and they were working together at the time. And she's walking down the hallway to me, and I had admired her because she was such a good actress. And she starts spouting Staying Alive to me. Like, she just is spouting this one speech from Staying Alive, which is, you know, I don't know it. She knew it. I don't know it. And the only reason I recognized it was because, you know, it ends up with everybody uses everybody, don't they? And I was like, oh, that must be my speech from Staying Alive. That must be it. As she's walking towards me, she's just reciting this thing. She's coming closer. And I'm like a deer in the headlights. I'm like, okay. And she says, me and my sister, we play those roles together all the time. And we know all your words from Staying Alive. And I'm like, you do?
Let's fast forward to 2012. You made your return to General Hospital. And suddenly you found yourself briefly romancing Tony Geary's Luke and working again with Tristan and with Ian and Anders. The GH audience, of course, could not have been more embracing of your return. And they were so thrilled to have Anna back. But what was your re-entrance onto the GH scene like?
Well, I think coming back to GH was obviously something that I really wanted to do. And I came at a great time in my life. And a lot of dreams came true, actually, for me, because I got to work with Tony Geary, who was, you know, obviously one of my big heroes. And then, you know, we became really good friends. And I've been out to see him in Amsterdam. I took my two kids to see him there. And I also got to work with Maurice. That was like a big, you know, bucket list thing for me. Because, you know, I always admired both of those actors. And so, you know, those things happened for me. I loved it. It was great. And I think, you know, I came in with, you know, that big story that my daughter Robin had passed away. And so, you know, you come in on a big emotional sort of roller coaster, which is a good way to enter in a way. And it's just been wonderful. I mean, I think there's a lot of aspects to it. I think having Frank as your executive producer, it has been a real gift, because, like, I knew him in New York. We went out to dinner several times, and I've always admired him and just always found him very interesting. And he's a super interesting guy. He's kind of a Renaissance man. He's a sort of throwback in a way to Gloria, because he also has his hand in everything that happens. Like, he's on the set. He comes down a couple of times a day, which Gloria used to was there all the time. And, you know, so, and I think that because soaps have gone through so many changes over the past decade, I think you need somebody at the helm that is determined to keep the bus moving and really wants to keep this genre alive. And he has his heart and soul in it. And everybody that's on the show really feels like that. You know, all the actors really feel like that. You know, I mean, I think it's a really nice time to be on a soap, because there's only four of us left. And I think we love doing it. Everybody that's doing the soaps right now really loves it, and are really invested in keeping this storytelling alive. And I think it's a nice time.
So, Finola, we are far from the only Finola Hughes fans with questions for you. So we're going to pose a few to you from some General Hospital castmates.
Oh, seriously?
Uh-huh.
Castmates?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, no.
So this question comes from a Mr. Michael Easton, who, of course, plays Finn. He says, obviously, you are exceptional at doing accents. Most people probably don't realize you're actually from South Dakota. But if you were to tire of the whole British thing, who would be the one great character in fiction you would love to play and why?
Carol Lombard. Mm. And I would like to do one of those real blondes from that era. You know, the ones that kind of really strutted in and they always held the gun at the end. And bombshell blondes were pretty cool from the 1930s and 40s. So, and Carol Lombard, I think, was special because she had that real love affair with Clark Gable, with Clark Gable. And I remember reading biography or something like years and years ago that when she passed away, you know, when she died on that plane. I just feel like, you know, if I did stop being English, you know, for the day and I really did, you know, go with the Dakota accent, which I'm not entirely sure what that's like, but I'm sure Michael will tell me. Then, yeah, Carol Lombard.
Well, question number two is from Roger Howarth, who plays Austin. He thinks you are a phenomenal
These two
actress.
Guys, by the way, talking of dreams coming true, Michael Easton has been just a revelation for me. I mean, it was just playing that love affair between Anna and Finn was just a walk along a wonderful path with cherry blossoms and what have you. It was just great. It was just awesome. And then Roger Howarth, who I see in the hallway, I never actually get to work with him. And we just have these real esoteric conversations that I walk away from not really understanding. But during the moment, I play a good, you know, song.
Well, he obviously feels the same way. He thinks you are a phenomenal actress and admits to having stolen from you. And I should clarify that when an actor talks about stealing from an actor, they essentially mean trying to reproduce something that they've seen another actor do. So he wants to know, who was the last actor you stole from and did it work?
The last actor I stole from is, probably Kate Winslet in Mare of Easttown. Because her no-nonsense, her no-nonsense with how she was dealing with certain aspects of Law and Order, I kind of liked. And, you know, I don't get to play very much of that Law and Order stuff. I wish I got to do a bit more of it. But, you know, sometimes I just really I like the way she was doing. She was throwing her weight around. She was just really, you know, she was really committed to that kind of straight matter of fact. I would say Kate Winslet.
The next question comes from Cameron Matheson, who you worked with on All My Children when he played Ryan and are working with again now that he has joined GH's Drew. He says, I'm looking forward to the Drew Anna Valentine triangle. What does Drew have to do to win you over? And then as a side note, he wants you to know that some of his favorite memories of All My Children were getting to work with you.
Yes, we did have a great time working together. And he makes me laugh too. He's, okay, so what he has to do to win me over is basically blink. Just open and close those baby blues. Yeah, I think that'll do it. That triangle, well, I think that, I don't know, yeah.
Well, next up is James Patrick Stewart, Valentine, who asks, number one, how do you take your tea? And number two, Land Rover or Aston Martin?
Okay. How I take my tea is always hour upon hour. I take my tea no milk with honey. So no milk and honey, which I'm sure will make me have to give my English subject card back. But anyway, yes. And what was the second question?
Land Rover.
Oh, Land Rover, for sure. A green one. A dark green one or a cream one. A real cream one. That would be beautiful.
Okay. All right, the final questions come from Michael E. Knight, another former All My Children co-star who played Tad and is currently playing opposite you as Martin on GH. Number one, New York or London? And number two, how do you stay fit eating so much toast?
See, no, I do. I eat so much toast. Like literally I can eat it three times a day. It's a perfect food. It's a complete, like, it's an all round food. London now is sort of overwhelming to me. Not that New York isn't, but I just feel like I wouldn't know where to start in London. And whereas New York, there's something so, I know it's fast and people are, you know, rude and they're like, already at Starbucks already. And, you know, they just, that was a bad Nebraska accent. But there's something so forgiving about New York, because there's something like, I've always felt like it's a huge monster that starts about 4 a.m. in the morning. It keeps going till about 3 a.m. the next day. And it's just this big monster, and you get on it and you ride it until you go to bed. And there's something so forgiving about everybody who's on the dragon. You know, they're all like on there, they're holding on for it, and the wind is blowing in their hair, and they're just holding on to the monster as it goes. And they look over to the other people and they're like, yeah, I see ya. And I know it's hard, but we got this. And I just feel like that in New York. I just feel that sort of thing, like you're all in it together. And the reason that somebody says, are you getting on the subway or not, is because they need to get on the subway. And if they don't wake you up, you're probably not going to get where you need to go either. So it's like, come on, you on or you off? Like, because I need to get on. And so I don't know. I mean, I love them. The moment that I've always been in love with New York, but the moment that I totally fell in love with it when I moved out there was one morning. It was after I'd been there for 6 months, and I was still coming to terms with the fact that parking could cost you $17 for 20 minutes. And I was like, what? You didn't get out within the 15. I was like, it was 25 minutes. Like, no, I'm sorry. Every half hour, it's $17. And I was just like, I couldn't come to terms with it. Well, one day it was snowing and all the subways were closed. The buses were done. No cabs we had. And I had to get in my Jeep to go to work. And I was so nervous. I hadn't driven in New York. But of course, there was nobody. And the whole of the West Side Highway was blanketed in white. And I drove down the West Side Highway at 6 a.m. in the morning. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. This, I'm in love. I'm sold. Done. Done deal. Where do I sign? I'm in. And that was the moment, you know? And I picture myself there in my old age with a little plastic bag that I've picked up at the supermarket. And it's full of maybe canned pineapple now, because I'm not sure I'll be able to cut into it. And, you know, maybe some tuna for the cat or whatever. And I've got my little plastic bag and I'm shuffling around back to my apartment. And that's, I could see myself doing that, because I think New York is a great place to grow old.
To your current story now, we are seeing a possible romance blossoming between Anna and Valentin. So tell us what you think about that and about working with James Patrick Stewart.
Well, James is fantastic. I mean, I've known James for years and years and years. We were at the same acting coach. We were at the same acting coach together. So I love him. And he's the laugh. You know, all the boys that you ask questions of, like, they're all super funny, which is really nice. I don't know. I mean, I think, like, he has such acting chops that you just kind of lean into it. I mean, he's another one like Michael Lee. You just sort of lean into the scene and you know he's going to catch you. And he works really hard. And we do these weird things, like we call each other and we FaceTime each other the night before we work. And we talk about the scene. And, you know, it's kind of cool. I'm very excited, because I think that, you know, where Michael Easton's character, where Finn was trepidatious about Anna lying, Valentin and Anna, they expect that of each other. And I think that's the difference. I think that they can move forward with their boundaries being a little more muted in a way. Mm-hmm. So.
Great. I just like that he's so unabashedly all about her. I appreciate that. We had a conversation a few months ago about how, like, Anna needed a win, was I think how you put it. I think a lot of viewers agreed with you on that. I know I did. You know, she had all this guilt over Peter, and then she was taking a lot of heat from Maxie, from Finn, for lying, for covering for Peter and so forth. But I feel like in the past few months, it's been like a breath of fresh air. And I feel like we've seen sort of a turn in a more winning direction, perhaps we'll say. Have you gotten that sense too, that like Anna's kind of getting her groove back? And if so, what do you attribute it to?
Yeah, it's the writers. The writers have started to put things in there where I've stopped apologizing and, you know, I'm starting to fight back a little bit. And, you know, I really hope that it goes the full force. You know, I don't know how that's going to translate over the next few months. But, yeah, I do really feel that Anna needs a win. Like, she just needs to. And I think that it comes from yourself, like from oneself. I mean, if the writers are sort of looking into it psychologically, she does have to stop apologizing, and she does have to start stepping up to the people that are holding her back, which you know, she's got to figure out the Peter thing. And I was thinking about the Peter thing actually earlier, and that the biggest point of the whole Peter thing now is Maxie and keeping the baby safe. And you know, of course, she doesn't know where the baby is. But that to me is, because that's the relationship between Peter and Maxie is the one that has the most to lose and the most to gain from getting rid of Peter, because Maxie's really in danger. I don't believe that Anna thinks that she's in danger. And I don't think, you know, I mean, I think she knows that he's kind of a difficult person to deal with, mm-hmm. but I think that she, if that Maxie portion of it is looked after, I think would be, and I'd love Anna to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not a big secret that a lot of viewers did have a tough time accepting the idea that Anna had a son with Faison, which we know is not the case. Peter is her nephew. Now, obviously you don't write the show, but did you understand where that resistance was coming from the audience?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. And it's interesting because going into the story, I did not see that coming. I know that's probably naive, but I was like, oh, you know, it just could have been something that happened back then, but I guess it shouldn't have. And so it's interesting. It's like the writers and the audience had the characters back. And so they sort of rewrote it. And and I think it's better, obviously. Anna has that sort of hero thing that I think people want to believe in. And that's kind of nice.
Well, last year you celebrated the 35th anniversary of your GH debut, incredibly enough. But before we let you go, can you put into words how getting that job and playing Anna has changed your life and, you know, just what GH has meant to you both personally and professionally?
Well, it means everything. Like, you know, I feel like GH is my family. You know, my work family for sure. I feel like it's made it possible for me to stay here in America. You know, it made it possible for me to live here. And it's created an incredible life for me. And it's also, you know, fulfilled so many wishes and dreams of just being an actor and just acting every day. You know, I like we are as soap actors, we're so lucky. And I don't think people understand that a lot of actors only work for a portion of the year, and we get to work and play all year round. And you know, it's a really interesting way of working because you're creating, but on the one hand, you're also very much part of a not business, but it is a business in a way. It's the business of making this piece of television that goes out every single day. And you work very closely with everybody. So, you know, it's not like going to a film set where you're not called all day. You know, you do work all the time that you're there. And I just, you know, it's I think we're just very lucky. And I get to see the same people every day. And, you know, you get to hang out. Like I hung out with James and Roger yesterday in the hallway, and it was really funny. And so it's a huge part of my life. And I feel very fortunate that I got that gig all those years ago.
Well, we feel fortunate that we got to talk to you today and hear all of your stories. Thank you so much. And we hope to do this again soon, because trust, we have like a whole other list of questions to ask you next time. But have a great day.
I think that's it. Like, I don't think there are any other questions. I literally think that's it. There's nothing else.
Well, thank you. It was so great to talk to you, and have a great day.
Thank you. I will.
Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to Fionnuala Hughes for being our guest. If you like this podcast, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to pick up a new issue on sale now and come back next week for another podcast.